And one of the ways to do that is to provide homes for people, right? To provide strip malls so that shops can open, right? So that those shops can employ people and generate more economic productivity and all this sort of stuff, right? So real estate, again, it comes back to real estate being, you know, one of the cornerstones of the economy, and then therefore that set of incentives that we see in the tax code.
Welcome to the Real Estate Professional Status Podcast. Join me as I sit down with the tax experts and real estate investors to learn how you can qualify for the real estate professional status and how you can use it to amplify your real estate investments. My name is Usher Fried. Let's get right to it.
I'm Jeremy Wells. I am both an enrolled agent and a certified public accountant CPA. I have been an EA and running my own tax and accounting firm called JWell CFO for going on 6 years now, and a CPA as of last year here in the state of Florida. And Florida itself, of course, is home to a lot of individuals who are interested in real estate investing. I live about half an hour south of Jacksonville, Florida. Jacksonville has been for a few years now one of the hottest real estate markets in the country. So real estate is definitely a topic that comes up a lot in my firm, real estate investing. Work with several real estate investors, real estate agents, real estate brokerages. So a lot of the work that my firm does centers around the real estate world.
You remind me of the concept that if you want to sell lemonade or you want to sell something, go to where people are hungry.
That's right.
You know, so if you want to help people with their taxes, go to places where people who want help with taxes would be in your specific niche.
For sure. You can tell that I heard this a long time ago, right? When you're on the interstate and you're driving into a big city and you start seeing the skyscrapers, right? Notice the names that are on those big towers. And what are they? They're the banks, the insurance brokerages, right? That's where all the money is. The big buildings, the big names are the banks and the brokerages. But when you look at the tax code, right? When you look at the tax laws of the country, it's that, you know, the financial sector obviously plays a pretty big part in the tax code. So you see insurance, you see banking mentioned a lot throughout the tax code. But the thing that really drives the tax code is real estate. You know, and it may not necessarily be explicit, but a lot of the rules and, you know, especially purview of this podcast, but a lot of the rules that exist in the tax code are there because of the real estate industry.
Right. So now, could you expand on that a little bit before we get into it? Because I think this is a good background for people who are looking to get into real estate or looking to take advantage of the real estate professional status, that they really understand why the tax code is so friendly.
Yeah. So a couple of things. One, you know, in order to do anything, you've got to do it somewhere. And, you know, even though we're in the 21st century here, and a lot of the economy is now digital and online, right? So much of our economy is still actually being somewhere, whether you live somewhere, you rent somewhere, you own that piece of property. And then, of course, all the land that's out there, somebody owns it, right? Somebody's doing something with it. Either they're holding it for investment for long term, and so it may not be developed now, or it's in some state of development. They're putting up houses, putting up condos, putting up commercial development, right? You know, they're building factories on it. Something is being done with that land. It's just a huge part of the economy, right? And, you know, we know when you look over just the last, you know, 15, 20 years, as goes the real estate market, so goes the whole economy. And, you know, what caused the Great Recession of 2007, 2008, 2009 was, you know, a lot of bad deals going on in the real estate market, and the bottom fell out of that, and it took a lot of the economy with it. Now, over the last couple of years, we've seen a resurgence of interest in real estate. We had a lot of financing that came out, a lot of relatively easy money and credit pumped into the system due to the pandemic. And a lot of interest, or resurgence of interest in what to do with that cash, with that credit. And investing in real estate has become one of those ways that you can park that money into an investment with the potential of making some decent money along the way, and or, you know, holding those assets long term for the appreciation. So, you know, there's an economic and a financial side to real estate. And when you think about that from the perspective of the tax code, right, what is the government actually trying to do with the tax code? And, you know, everybody's going to have their different takes on this, and some of it gets political and ideological, and I don't want to wade into that here, obviously, but you've got to look at the tax code as a system of incentives. We joke about the IRS and about armed agents and showing up at your door in the middle of the night and, you know, going to jail because you, you know, forgot to carry the one when you were adding up figures for your tax return and all that kind of stuff. Well, you know, a lot of that gets blown way out of proportion. But here's the truth about the tax code, right? We do have, and this is a term that, you know, depending on which portion of the internet you're looking at, can get kind of carried away. People can get kind of carried away with. But we have what's called a voluntary system, right? That you self-report your income to the system, and therefore, you know, what your tax liability based on that income is. There's a lot going on your tax return, especially if you're doing more sort of complex, out of the ordinary kind of activity, right? If all you're doing is showing up to your job and you're an employee and you get your W-2 at the end of the year, yeah, that's all reported by your employer to the IRS, right? But even then, right, we're relying on a private company to report to the IRS what they paid you, and therefore you then now have a requirement to report that on your end to the IRS, right? So again, it's still self-reporting, right? All of this is relying on citizens and private businesses to report all of this information to the Internal Revenue Service, and then, you know, whatever your tax agency inside your state is, usually Department of Revenue, something like that. So if you think about that, and absent any kind of enforcement, why would anybody report anything, right? You know, I just not do any of it, right? But there is enforcement. So we want to avoid that. We want to avoid having tax law imposed upon us through the process of enforcement. So we do have an incentive to self-report. But on the flip side of that, we want to self-report it in a way that minimizes the damage to our wallets as much as possible. This is really, you know, coming at it from a tax professional, this is really what I'm trying to help my customers, you know, the taxpayers that I work with, do as much as possible, right? Is keep them in a way to where they have some peace of mind, right? They're not worried about IRS agents, you know, sending them notices or showing up at their door, that sort of stuff. And I've had some cases where, you know, I haven't had IRS agents visiting my taxpayers, but I do get notices, right? You know, they get notices.
You prepare them so well that the IRS had no case against it.
Well, absolutely, right? And so that's the point. You know, we want to try to make sure that things are presented in such a way that, yeah, IRS is going to disagree, right? They're going to say, no, we're going to do the math a little differently. And we come back and we say, well, actually, you know, we think our math is sound and here's why. Right. So, you know, that's part of it. And so we're trying to find the right balance between minimizing the hit both today and in the future. And, you know, that's one of the trade-offs. Sometimes we got to do things where you pay a little bit less tax now, but that means you might pay a little bit more later. Sometimes we decide to do things the opposite. Let's pay a little more tax now and not have to pay so much later. Right. And then in the meantime, over that stretch of time, we're trying to minimize that total amount as much as possible. And the tax code is where we find ways to do that, right? So the tax code is full of these incentives to try to get people to pay in their taxes, to want to report as accurately as possible and to pay in their taxes, but also act in a way that can reduce that amount, but is also economically beneficial. And one of the ways to do that is to provide homes for people, right? To provide strip malls so that shops can open, right? So that those shops can employ people and generate more economic productivity and all this sort of stuff, right? So real estate, again, it comes back to real estate being, you know, one of the cornerstones of the economy, and then therefore that set of incentives that we see in the tax code.
All right. So let me just recap that. It's like a double loop over here, right? You mentioned that the government, and I think most people don't realize this, the tax code is set up in a way to incentivize you to pay taxes, to pay and to report. And number two, real estate also has its own incentives, which generally what people know to be true is everyone needs a place to live. And that's why the government incentivizes you. That's like the classic reason. You said something else. Real estate is a big part of the economy. So the government wants to keep the economy going. Therefore, it will be tax friendly to the real estate sector because they know the part that the real estate sector plays in it. If Very interesting.
Yeah, I heard a statistic a long time ago, and I don't remember the source, and I don't remember if it's accurate or not. But, you know, it's one of those things that just kind of becomes, you know, folk theory that people say it. We all kind of accept it to be true. But it was along the lines of every time a single family residence is built from scratch, that creates something on the order of like 30 to 35 jobs. Permanent jobs. Because you think about it, right? Somebody needs to have an income in order to build and buy that house, but then they're going to pay that income to the developers, and the developers are going to have architects and engineers to design the house. They're going to have pay the actual contractors to build the house. The contractors are going to need to go buy tools and supplies from the supply houses, the Home Depots, the Lowe's, right? All these kinds of things. They're going to hire employees to stock all the shelves, but they're getting their raw goods. They're getting the timber and the tools from the manufacturers and the lumber yards and all. And so when you have this cascading effect, right, throughout the economy, where, you know, for a lot of people, it's just, oh yeah, we're just buying a house, right? And that's just the actual material producing the house, right? We're not even getting into the administrative part. The developer's got to have somebody on site to actually sell the house. They've got to have salespeople when the transaction is done. You've got to have the title agent. You've got to have the real estate agent. You've got to have the bankers if there's financing, right? So you've got to have all these different people involved. And to a lot of people, yeah, it's a big event in your life if you buy a house, right? But it's a big event in a lot of other people's lives too.
Yeah.
When you take all of that in the aggregate, you know.
Super interesting. Super interesting. You know, all real estate investors and people who get into real estate for the tax purposes, like that's what they're focused on. How could I pay less in taxes? And they think, or people think at large, that how we're avoiding or evading the government. Evading is not the right word, but the point is we're like sidestepping taxes, and we found out the rules, how we could avoid it and why not. And meanwhile, they're laughing because we're like going after the incentive to actually create an economy. So while we're so single-mindedly focused on pay less in tax, we're creating jobs along the way. We're creating infrastructure. We're pushing society further.
Absolutely.
I think that's important for people to know, to sort of have that wholesome approach, because it's not a hack. It's not hacking the system. That is the system. The system is there for people to be incentivized to go into real estate so they could take advantage of the code. Now, the IRS still, I'm assuming, has to protect the code and make sure that that doesn't get abused. So they'll come after you if they think you're abusing it. But as long as you stick to the code, it's there for you.
And, you know, again, it's a balance, because when we say the code, right, you know, we're using that as shorthand for tax law. There's a lot of different sources of tax law. And I'm only talking about the federal level here, right? Because when you actually look at all of the different jurisdictions in the United States, one country out of almost 200 countries in the world, when you look at it, all of the different jurisdictions that actually impose some kind of tax, actually levy some kind of tax within its jurisdiction, within its, you know, geographic domain, it's like 6,000 something different tax jurisdictions. We've obviously got one country with IRS responsible for enforcing the federal tax code, but then we've also got 50 states. Some of them don't have an income tax, right? I think about 30, 38, 39, 40, something like that actually do, right? So you've got state income taxes. And then within those states, you've got counties, you've got cities, you've got townships, right? You've got all these different jurisdictions that can impose taxes. So trying to keep up with all of that and all of the changes, a monumental task.
While trying to take care of your family.
Right. Exactly.
I'm struggling with that part.
Here. Yeah, there you go. So, you know, and just at the federal level, there's enough going on there, right? There's enough changes. There's enough complexity just right there, you know, that you can make an entire career out of just keeping up with it. So if we just look at the federal level and we think about tax law, right? When we say tax law, you know, what are we actually looking at? And part of tax law actually defines this for us. So as a tax professional, we have to rely on what we call substantial authority, right? If I recommend that you take a certain position on your tax return, right? You come into some money, and by definition, right, the federal tax law tells us this, by definition, if you come into some money, if you have some sort of financial gain, that is taxable unless there's something specific in the tax law that says it isn't, right? So what do we start doing? Well, we start looking through all that tax law and see if we can figure out a way to make it not taxable for you, right? See if we can make it exempt, right? And so what does that mean? Where am I looking? Am I just going to Google and finding a blog post that says it's not taxable and now I run with that? No, don't do that, right? Some people do, but I don't recommend it, right? So where do we go? Well, we've got what we call the tax code, the Internal Revenue Code, right? It's Title 26 of the U.S. Code, the compendium of all federal tax law, right? This is the Bible. Internal Revenue Code.
The Bible. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. But, and Congress, not the IRS, Congress writes the tax code. They write the Internal Revenue Code. So this is law. This is law passed by Congress, signed by the president. IRS doesn't have anything to do with authoring the tax code, right? But the tax code isn't the whole story. There are gaps in the tax code. There are places where the language isn't 100% clear. There are places where, by definition, it's written into the tax code that Congress says, you know what, there's some nuance here and there's some detail that we could have included, but that's beyond what we want to get into. And so we're actually going to give authority to the Department of Treasury to actually figure out all the little details and the nuances. If you actually read through the tax code, you'll find in a lot of the sections will end with a short paragraph that says something like, the Secretary of the Treasury is authorized to figure out all the details for how to actually, you know, fill in the gaps of this code section that we just wrote. So what does that mean? The next layer below the tax code is what we call the Treasury regulations. And this is where IRS comes in. This is where the IRS, as their job of being the chief tax collectors of the United States, come in and say, you know what, Congress left some details out here and we're not really sure how to do our jobs if we don't have those details. So we got to write them, right? And the law itself says we can write it. So we're going to come up with the details. Now, it's a lengthy process. It's a long process. They get a lot of input. They get input from other tax agencies, from economists, from tax experts, from attorneys, from CPAs, right? From a lot of different sources. They get a lot of public input, and they go through the process of putting together what's called the Treasury regulations. As a tax professional, somebody trying to help my customers who are taxpayers, yeah, I start with the tax code. There's a detail missing. I go to the Treasury regulations. Hopefully there's some more detail here in the Treasury regulations where I can actually figure out a way to help my taxpayer here, right? And what IRS does that's really helpful is a lot of time they'll actually put examples. They make them up, but they use real world sort of terminology and amounts and that sort of stuff. They'll fill the regulations with these examples to kind of help you work through. And not every example is going to fit your particular case exactly, but you try to find an example that's close enough to say, yeah, if IRS would have decided on this way, given these facts, then I think that's close enough to what, you know, this taxpayer is dealing with, so we can run with this. And then, of course, even the regulations, though, sometimes don't have all the details. Sometimes there are conflicts within the regulations. One regulation will say one thing, another one will say a different thing, and you can kind of figure out somewhere in between that you fit. So, you know, I'm not sure what to do here. And that's when we got to get the courts involved, right? If you have a situation where the tax liability is enough to where you've got enough skin in the game to where you want to pay the attorneys all the money to go to court over it, you can sue the IRS. There are a couple different ways you can do that. One is through the U.S. tax court. There's an actual tax court. Another one is to go through the normal court system, to start with the U.S. district courts. And every now and then, you'll even see a tax issue make it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So there's a combination of what Congress has written in the tax code, what IRS and the Department of Treasury has come up with and the Treasury regulations, and then what the courts have come up with. Now, remember, all of this started with the 16th Amendment in 1913. Before that, the U.S. had taxes, different kinds of taxes over time, but nothing that was permanent. 1913, this is when we first get the U.S. income tax, and then from there, you know, so we're only talking about 110 years here, you know, which in the big scheme of, you know, human history is not that long, right? We've got this combination of Congress, the IRS, and the courts trying to figure out what's the best way to regulate the economy and regulate individual economic and financial behavior through taxation, and at the same time incentivize people to be economically productive and to file their tax returns accurately and on time. Right? So yeah, it's a relatively huge system.
Wow.
And so, like I say, you find through that period, there are certain things that have just kind of had their way through their influence on Congress, through their influence on the Treasury Department, and through having the capacity to get their issues pushed through the court system. Who has the money to have these big cases go through the court system, wind up at the Supreme Court? Well, it's a lot of big billion-dollar companies like insurance companies and banks and real estate developers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now you bring a different dimension to the conversation. You're saying that Congress decided the tax laws, but to further break them down and fill the gaps, the IRS has some autonomy over that. But even that is limited. And that's when, if you, let's say, an accountant, a CPA, and the IRS have an argument about an interpretation, that's when you go to the tax courts to decide. There's not a lot of absolute here because it's such a large system and because so many, not just people involved, but entities, thousands, and at this point, hundreds of thousands of people at different times in different places have made an imprint on this for its purpose to tax people and also have in mind the incentives to keep the economy running and whatnot. So
yeah, absolutely.
The dimension that you're like, I think that makes a huge impact over here that sort of corrects what I initially said is that real estate, while the tax code is made to incentivize that we buy real estate, there has still been influence by insurance companies, people with the money to make it maybe a little bit more incentivized. The people with the money were the people in real estate that had real estate, and therefore they were incentivized to fight certain things. Let's say, you know, there's some issue, and I'm not going to come up with a good example here, but the people that are into it don't have money, right? So unfortunately, they could be right all they want. They don't have the money to push their agenda forward, which is not such a great thing, but it's part of life. Real estate, you have the advantage that generations before you, people that had that incentive to buy real estate had the incentive to push and make the laws a little bit easier for them. And therefore, you, as the scientists start investing in real estate, you have like had an army just plow the fields for you and make way for you to go ahead and take advantage. You know, take advantage, not just because of that wholesome speech I gave in the beginning, but also there is certain inroads that people have made because they had the money to fight.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, everything scales, right? Everything in an economy is big and complex as the U.S. and the legal system is big and complex as the U.S. It scales, right? So there are all these posts, all these videos online about, you know, tax secrets of the rich or, you know, money secrets of the rich, this sort of stuff, right? Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there's always just enough truth in those things to be inspirational enough to say, hey, well, I can make this work for me too, right? The problem with that is a lot of these secrets, these hacks, these strategies, one, they're only profitable if you can invest a ton of money and time into them, right? And where is that money and time going? Well, a good chunk of the money is going into the actual investment itself, right? We're going to buy a lot of real estate with this money. But anybody who's ever done a real estate transaction, whether, you know, you're buying an investment property or just buying your own personal house, you know that there's a lot of money that changes hand that doesn't actually wind up going into the actual price of whatever it is you're buying, right? You've got to pay all the professionals that are involved in that process. You've got to pay the title agent. You got to pay the real estate commission. You got to pay the insurance. You got to pay the bankers, the mortgage officer. You know, you got to pay all these people that are ancillary and critical, but ancillary to the actual transaction itself, right? And that's part of it. Then when you get to the level to where you've got that much money and that much personal wealth on the line, you're going to do everything you can to make sure that the deal is as ironclad and bulletproof as possible. And who's going to help you with that? Your tax advisors, your attorneys, right?
Jeremy.
Yeah.
Jeremy will help you with that.
Right, exactly. I wish, right? So, you've got to be able to not just have money to buy the investment itself, but you've got to have enough additional money to pay all the people that are going to help you with that transaction also. And that, yeah, it's an expense. It can be deductible depending on what kind of transaction we're talking about. But that's just money that you got to hope that the investment itself can cover during whatever holding period you're going to hold that for, because it's just gone. It's just expense. It's out the window. It's not building up your value in that actual asset, whatever it is. For a lot of people who invest in the stock market, for example, right? Think about brokerage fees. You can't just go to Wall Street and start buying shares of stock that you want to invest in. You got to have help with that. So you've got a brokerage. Well, how does the brokerage stay in business? Well, they charge you a fee based on how much you invest. And real estate is the same way. So the scaling part here is the kinds of strategies and tactics, and therefore the risk profile and the potential payoffs for somebody who's got the assets and the access to credit and the wherewithal to buy one single family property that they're going to rent out is going to be very different than the developer or the investment firm that can go out here and buy hundreds and thousands of properties. And we saw this over the last couple of years during the pandemic with just massive increase in prices, in real estate prices, because we saw where, for example, families would try to buy their next home, but they were getting outbid 10, 20, 25% above the seller's asking price by some institutional buyer, you know, somebody that's going to come in, and usually not even a person, an entity, a company that's going to come in and buy that property and turn it into a rental. And so, you know, this is where we get back to incentives, right? What are we actually incentivizing here? Are we incentivizing individuals to go buy homes so they've got a place to live? Or are we incentivizing developers to build new houses? Are we incentivizing institutional investors to go buy lots of properties and start renting them out? And we're incentivizing all of that a little bit to different degrees.
Right.
And you've got to figure out where you want to be at in that system and what you've actually got the capacity and the wherewithal to be able to start playing that game.
Yeah. I mean, I would argue with my basic understanding that it is incentivized for the people who are going to invest and buy the properties and rent them out. Because while, yeah, there is someone that loses over here, and it's the first-time home buyer, someone trying to buy a home to put a roof and own the property, the people who are trying to be served here are the people who can't even afford to buy a home, right? So yep. While you might look at it as like investor versus first-time home buyer, you're like, oh, the rules are not fair, which they aren't fair. But at the same time, it's not necessarily there for the investor. It's there for the renter who, you know, is maybe living paycheck to paycheck and could never even dream of owning a home. The government wants there to be homes available for them.
Yeah. And, you know, this is where we actually get into the topic of the podcast, right? So like, who are these incentives actually geared toward? And there's a variety of different ways that these incentives can show up. But if we're talking about individuals who want to get in on the real estate game, this is where this concept of the real estate professional pops up. You know, how do we incentivize individuals to actually want to go out and purchase rental properties and start renting them? How do we make that tax efficient for them to do that? Now, the interesting thing is in the tax code itself, the term real estate professional, it isn't there. It's what we use as shorthand for particular set of passages of the tax code, right? So this is the actual law that Congress wrote. And then, like I said before, there's details missing. So we've actually got sections in the regulations that fill in all the gaps, that fill in all the details here. But from all of that, we call that together into what we call the real estate professional, right? And probably the better way to put it is the way you've titled the show, which is real estate professional status. Because just putting it out there, real estate professional, and I see this when, you know, I talk to prospective customers a lot, is somebody will come to me and say, oh yeah, I'm a real estate agent, therefore I am a real estate professional, right? Maybe on the street, you can call yourself a real estate professional. But that's not what I'm interested in. What I'm interested in is, does the tax code consider you a real estate professional? So what does that actually mean? There are two tests, right? There are two ways you become a real estate professional, and you've got to pass both of these tests. The first one is you've got to spend at least 750 hours a year actually in real estate trades or businesses. And this is what, this is the language that the tax code uses. And again, it's one of these things where there's some more detail given about what real estate trades or businesses.
What is a real trade or business?
Exactly.
That's 11
What is a real estate trade or business, right? Yeah.
And then in that, you got to break it down.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll start there, right? So 750 hours in that. And this is the one that can tend to trip people up because, you know, if you think about, let's say you're a real estate agent, right? Well, yeah, you can, I don't know, you can maybe get 750 hours in half a year, right? You know, if they're hustling for your for your customers, right? Trying to find them deals, especially in this kind of market, right? So like 750 hours, that's usually the easy part. Here's where it gets a little tougher for the people who are actually trying to take advantage of the tax benefits that you get as a real estate professional that are not coming at this from spending their entire lives, right? And making all of their income from real estate. And this
is a W-2 regular worker who's trying to get involved.
Exactly.
In real estate,
right. Yeah. So you've got a day job. Your job is working, you know, I don't know what
you're
doing.
An accountant.
Right. You're an accountant. Exactly. That's a great example, right? The second part, the second test is you've got to spend at least half of your working time in those real estate trades or businesses. And right. That's the part that usually trips people up because they'll come and say, oh yeah, I bought a rental earlier in the year. I've spent way more than 750 hours. We had to fix it up. We had to clean it. We had to renovate it. You know, we had to find renters. We got renters in there. We had to furnish it. You know, now I'm managing them. Now I'm going and doing repairs, you know, and cleaning things up between renters and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, no, way more than 750 hours. I'll say, okay. But I noticed you also got this W-2 with, you know, $150,000, $200,000 of income from this other job. Is that full-time employment? Oh, yeah, sure. Right? Like, how do you think I'm paying for this rental, right? Okay, well, we got a problem here then. Because the general understanding here is that if you're a full-time employee somewhere that is not a real estate-focused business or job, you're not going to be spending more than half your working time on that real estate activity. It's just not going to happen. Maybe you're spending a quarter of your free time,
right?
But
even
it's definitely not going to be
900 hours.
Exactly.
Yeah, not
exactly. So you can get well over the 750 hours within a year, but if it's not more than half your working time in that real estate activity, you're never going to be a real estate professional as far as the tax code goes.
Right. Here's an interesting question on that. What if somebody, let's say he's an accountant, so basically, his day job involves real estate. Would that count as real estate hours or would that count as day job hours?
Yeah. So this is where we get into, right? What does real estate trade or business mean? And when we have to go that route, there's actually an additional qualification that we have to attach to it. But let's start here. So what's a real estate trade or business? Let's say you're a W-2 employee, but that work is with something that seems like it's in real estate. So what's actually there? This is one of the few times we actually get a little bit more detail here in the tax code, right? So the same part of the tax code that's talking about the 750-hour rule and the more than half your working hours in real estate rule, then we get this list of, okay, well, what is a real real estate trade or business? And they actually list a few things. So development, redevelopment, construction, acquisition, conversion, rentals,
reconstruction,
operation, management. Yeah, right. So leasing and brokerage. So the things that are 100%, yeah, of course, that's real estate. So real estate sales, real estate brokers, agents, brokers, that sort of stuff. No doubt. Developers, people who are actually working for companies that are doing the development, the construction, the renovations, all of that kind of stuff. Now, you can already start to see places where it's a gray area, right? Because, you know, I work for Home Depot, right? Like I'm a manager of a Home Depot and we sell a lot of lumber to real estate developers. Are we, you know, is this a real estate trade or business? No, right? I mean, we can only stretch this so far. And this is where a lot of people will say, like, I'm a mortgage broker, I'm a mortgage lender, right? And I see all these real estate investors come in, I want to get in on that. And, you know, 90% of my job is trying to secure financing for real estate investors. So I'm a real estate professional, right? No, sorry. Finance is not one of these listed real estate things, right? So there are these times where what's actually in the tax law and the way you can rationalize it in your head, if they're not 100% overlapping, then you're more than welcome to go take that position. I'm not going to be the one preparing your tax returns, though, when you take that position, right?
Yeah, interesting point you just made, that last little quip you said. You could take that position if you want, but I'm not going to do it for you. And I feel that this is a place tension between an accountant and the client. The client is telling you, just do it. But just do it, right? So yeah, you could check off the box, but as the accountant, you're taking the responsibility that you're going to be able to defend the client. And you're telling the client, I can't do that for you. You could do it, play games and lose big time.
Yeah.
You want to take that risk? I was speaking to an investor last week and he told me that, you know, he wants an accountant that could take risks, you know, that has big boy pants.
Yeah.
And it's not really the accountant that's taking risks. It's the guy taking risks. And you might be, well, gung-ho, let's risk this. You do not understand the repercussions. Someone who watched a couple of YouTube videos about real estate investing, taking advantages of the real estate tax codes from that guy who sold you a course for $9.97.
Well, I'll say this too, right, is there are risks for the preparer too, and those come in a variety of different ways. So you're the taxpayer, you take a position on your return, which you self-prepared, you used, you know, an online service to prepare your return or whatever, and you took some position that IRS disagrees with, and you decide to fight with IRS, and you end up losing that battle. So now you owe some more tax, you've got some penalties and interest attached to it, right? Assuming you didn't try to defraud the government, right? Now that's a whole other can of worms. Now you're talking criminal activity, right? But if you just took a position and it didn't work out for you, you owe some more money, all right? Bad enough. If you're a tax professional, if you're a certified public account preparing tax returns, if you're an enrolled agent, which is a license that the IRS gives to tax professionals to be able to represent taxpayers before the IRS, right? If you're an attorney who is preparing tax returns, there are lots of tax attorneys out there who will help their client prepare their tax returns. Or even if you're not a licensed preparer, right? If you decide to go to one of the retail options in a strip mall and use them to prepare your return, and that person is not licensed, but they're still acting as a tax preparer, right? They're still signing that return as the person who prepared it. There are penalties in the tax code for the preparer for taking a position on that return that they prepared that could come back to that professional. So that's one way that preparer can get in trouble, right? It is now there's an actual monetary penalty imposed on the preparer for preparing a return that took that position. That's in addition to whatever penalties they might assess on the actual taxpayer. And then if you are licensed, right? If you're professionally licensed, if you're an attorney, if you're an enrolled agent, if you're a CPA, you can get in trouble with IRS. IRS sends out an email. I think it's either once a month or once a quarter. They will send out an email to everybody on their list that includes other tax professionals of people that IRS has flagged for that kind of disreputable behavior. If you're a CPA, you might have a problem with your state licensing board.
Right.
If you took egregious positions on tax returns, and your CPA board can go as far as your professional licensing board can go as far as disbarring you, right? Saying you're taking your license away. And the same thing can happen to attorneys with their state bars, right?
So is that the case over here? Is that the case over here? If somebody claims reps for someone who let's say fails the test, does the accounting get those, or is it gray as well? Like depending on how badly they fail.
So this is what I mean by taking a position, right? So like where there are these gray areas, or where there are these sort of mental rationalizations of how you fit this definition that's written out, you know, in the tax law, and you're the only one in the world willing to actually take that position on that tax return, right? Nobody else is going to prepare that tax return based on the way you tried to rationalize it, whether you're the taxpayer or you're the preparer, you know, doing that return for that taxpayer. That's when we run into problems. That's when you're going to be brought up for taking these egregious positions. And depending on the nature of that position, if you do this and it's $1,000 difference on your tax return, yeah, okay, IRS is going to send the taxpayer a bill for $1,100 because they're going to throw in some penalties and interest, and that's going to be a problem. Now, if you're doing this for $25,000, $50,000, $150,000, it scales. The bigger the gap between what virtually everybody else in the profession says is the way you should have handled this and the way you chose to handle it, the bigger that gap gets, the bigger the problem is, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as an accountant, you have to have that in mind. If you think that there's not going to be such a big gap, but you don't agree, you might allow your client to take the position even though you don't agree, because you know that you'll be safe.
So here's the thing, and this is where it can get dicey, right? So
I think it's important for people looking for CPAs to know this.
Because I get the same thing. I'll get a prospective customer that'll schedule a discovery call with me, and one of the first things they'll say is, my last accountant, they just didn't take any risks, right? You know, like I wanted them to do a certain thing, and they gave me all the list of reasons why they couldn't, but none of it sounded right to me because I did my own research. And, you know, so I'm looking for a new accountant who will take risks, who will give me the best deal possible. I've heard all these things, right? So here's the thing about that sort of way of thinking about tax returns from the professional's perspective. My job is to provide you as the taxpayer with all of the options that I think are reasonable. This is the definition, and this is the standard that I'm held to by the tax law itself, right? I have to be able to advise you of a position and provide a reasonable basis, right? Substantial authority. These are some of the terms we use. The highest level is more likely than not, right? We think there's a greater than 50% chance that if we take this position on the return, that IRS is going to be fine with it, that the courts are going to be fine with it. Slightly below that is what we call substantial authority. They'll challenge it, but we can back it up. We can back it up with our reading, with our plain text reading of the tax law, code, the regulations, court cases, whatever. And then below that is reasonable basis that, you know, there's some wiggle room here, and we can't exactly point to something in the tax law or in the case law that supports us, but just thinking reasonably, right? Thinking out loud and nobody like laughing at us as we're saying this, right? We think we're good enough. If we can at least get to that point, right? Now, what are all the options? If we're saying that's the minimum standard we're willing to accept, here are the two different positions you could take on this tax return, and they both meet at least that reasonable basis. Right. There's at least a reasonable basis for these positions. Now, it's your tax return. Yeah, I'm preparing it. Yeah, I'm signing it. Yeah, I'm liable for some penalties if we do egregious, fraudulent stuff on here. But here are the two options. You tell me which one because it's your tax return. Right. And that's perfectly fine as a professional. Now, what I'm not allowed to do is to say, look, here are these two options. One of these, I think it'll fly right through. The other one, it'll probably get audited, right? That's what I'm not allowed to do. I'm not allowed to try to anticipate what will actually get audited or not. Or I'm not allowed to say, I filed 100 tax returns with this same way of doing it, and none of them ever got audited, right? I'm not allowed to base my advice on my record, or I've talked to 50 other tax professionals and none of them have gotten audited on this. We're not allowed to do that because now we're playing the audit game. Now we're just trying to see what we can get away with. And that's not actually advising you. That's not a standard of deciding whether this tax position is reasonable or not. It's not reasonable because nobody's ever audited it yet. Maybe they've just gotten lucky and haven't. Call that the audit lottery. Nobody's gotten pulled in the audit lottery yet, right? That's not a reasonable basis for saying that this position is something that I'm comfortable with you taking on this tax return. But what I can say is, based on my read of the tax law, I think this is the best course of action for you. By the way, here's this other option. I think it's got reasonable basis, maybe not as good. And then it really becomes a question of just what are you as a taxpayer comfortable with? Now, at any point in all this, taxpayer can say, no, that doesn't work for me. I need something more aggressive. I need something more risky. I need something, you know, that'll save me even more tax. And they're fine to walk, right? They're fine to go take that to another preparer who might be more willing to roll the dice with that kind of stuff. Or I can say, look, it's obvious that neither of these options are what you thought you were paying me for. Like, you seem pretty disappointed with that. You know what? Let's just go ahead and finish this now, because I'm not going to work with taxpayers that are constantly going to be trying to push me to be more and more aggressive when I know that I've now slipped beneath that standard that I have to uphold, right, as a professional.
Right, right. And I think it's very important for anyone who's looking to get the real estate professional status, you know, because it all starts with the CPA, because he's going to be the one that's going to say that you are a real estate professional status, to understand all of this and to take it all in context. And you found someone who might be more aggressive, you might just step into an audit. You never know. And I guess the best way I could think, and I would love to hear your thoughts, because this is step number one, finding a CPA, or CPA that you're already using, that is willing to give you that check that you're a real estate professional. So to walk away from your CPA to go to somebody else who will give you that status, but towards your risk, is that something you want to do before fully understanding what that action is? So
yeah,
I mean, the way you make it sound, obviously we're all limited because, let's say, me as a client or as a customer of yours, I don't know the rules. I'm trusting you. I'm trusting him. It's very hard to know who's being too cautious, who's being risky. I think that someone goes ahead and gives you that background and tells you, like, the language that you used. That is something, and he says that I feel that this is fine. That's something I would think a person could feel comfortable using that CPA, as opposed to going to a CPA like, oh, I'll give you rep status, no issue. Or, yeah, it's not a problem, right? Someone who doesn't speak in that language, I think that's a red flag.
Well, and let's be clear what we're really talking about here, right? So what does this real estate professional status actually get you, right? What it does is it changes the timing, okay? Because when we're talking about the tax benefits of real estate investing, what we're really talking about is timing. Okay, so what do I mean by that? By definition, again, this goes back to the tax law. In the tax code that Congress wrote, right, there's a section. It's called Section 469. You can read through it. 469 combined with the regulations that IRS wrote for 469, what they, you know, talking about the tax code and the regulation, every regulation ties back to a specific section of the code. So when you're talking about the 469 regulations, when you're talking about Section 469, all of that is the part of the tax law that has to deal with what we call passive losses. Now, what do we mean by passive losses? By definition, within Section 469 of the tax code, again, Congress wrote this. IRS did not write this. Congress wrote this. All rental income and losses, by definition, passive. Okay, fine. What does that mean, right? It just means that it's not non-passive, okay? Now, that sounds facetious, but what's the point there? Okay, you've got your W-2 job. You're making a wage. You're working for that, right? You're getting paid salary for the work that you did for that company. They reward you with compensation. Part of that is your salary, right? That is non-passive income, right? You start a business, a consulting business, right? You're doing consulting on the side. And so, you know, you're earning income from your customers through that. You're paying your business expenses. The net income of all that comes to you, right? That's taxable income to you. That is non-passive income. Now, there's a lot of other ways that we break down income into different groups. But for right now, the only distinction that matters is passive and non-passive. And by definition, all rental income and therefore losses are passive. Now, why does that matter? Because passive income and losses offset each other. So if you've got a $10,000 bit of passive income and a $10,000 bit of passive loss, they offset each other. Non-passive income and non-passive losses offset each other, right? Okay. Passive losses cannot offset non-passive income by definition. So the $150,000 of wages you made and the $20,000 of losses from your rental, right? The rental losses are passive. The wages are non-passive, with some exceptions, right? That we'll talk about in a minute. You can't combine those two things on the tax return, right? So what are the exceptions? Well, the first one is that up to $25,000 of those rental losses, those passive losses, can be applied against your non-passive income as long as your modified adjusted gross income, your MAGI, is below $150,000, right? Between $100,000 and $150,000, it actually phases out, right? So below $100,000, you get all the $25,000 passive losses. Over $150,000 of MAGI, all of that $25,000 is completely phased out. In between, it phases out ratably. Okay, why does this matter? Let's say you're a wage earner and your wages are $90,000. You've got no other income, but you also somehow own a rental that had a $20,000 loss last year. Well, you actually can take that $20,000, and because you're below that $100,000 threshold, you can actually offset $90,000 of your wage income with that $20,000 rental loss, right? Okay, cool. What if you've got $350,000 of wage income, no other income, you've got $100,000 of rental losses because you've got a real estate portfolio? Well, guess what? No luck, no dice. You don't get any of that unless, and again, this is another exception. Understanding the tax code is all about recognizing that there are rules and there are exceptions to the rules. And then sometimes there are exceptions to the exceptions, right? Like, it's like peeling back the layers of an onion, right? Like the top layer, here are the rules, right? But what's under that layer? Oh, here's an exception to this rule, right? And then you peel that back and it's like, oh, wait, there's an exception to that exception. And you just keep going deeper.
769.1A, B, 3, 7,
that's a great point, right? Because what's the top layer? Usually it's the tax code. Tax code is very direct. Tax code says rental income is passive, rental losses are passive, and passive losses can't offset non-passive income. Okay, well, that sucks, right? Oh, wait, here's an exception. For someone who qualifies as a real estate professional for that tax year, remember the two tests, the 750 hours in real estate trades or businesses, and then the more than half your time in real estate. If you pass those two tests within a tax year, right, then you qualify as a real estate professional for that year. Now you can offset your non-passive income with all those passive rental losses, right? So that's why if you're in the game, right? If you're a real estate investor, you want to do what you can to qualify. But if you're doing this on the side as a W-2 wage earner, you're going to struggle with this, right? Yeah.
Unless you're married.
Okay.
That's another thing, right?
With those two tests, right? This is a point of confusion that, because you brought it up, I want to clarify real quick, right?
Yeah.
You cannot combine, for the purposes of qualifying as a real estate professional, you can't combine both spouses, right? So, This is something that a lot of real estate investors will try to do. Say, oh, well, we split our time and the activity, right? Combined, we get the 750 hours. Doesn't work that way. It's one or the other. Now, for the material participation test, which is also part of all this passive loss calculation, right? Yeah, you can combine spouses.
We didn't touch on that, which is way beyond
the scope of this episode, right? But that's a point of confusion. Just because you can combine four as spouses for the material participation test, you cannot do that for the real estate professional status, right? So keep that in mind.
Right. 750 hours has to be done by one person. Like you said, the material participation, the seven tests for that, those could be combined. And obviously that will be covered in another episode.
Exactly. That, it took us an hour to get there, right? But I think it's important. I think it's important, especially early on in the conversation, to understand why are we even talking about this? And this is the problem with losing all the nuance when you see this as, some 90-second TikTok video, right? Or you read this as a blog post that, a 500-word blog post, right? Well, okay, so I just need to be a real estate professional and then all of a sudden I get all these benefits, right? Well, yes and no, right? Let's break this down. So yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a boon if you qualify for it and if you've got the kind of activity, the kind of real estate investor activity going on where you would want to unlock that. Now, back to the whole point, like, you're not getting any extra benefits. You're not getting any extra deductions as a real estate professional that you would get, that you wouldn't get as just a normal real estate investor. It's all about the timing, right? So what happens if you have rental losses, right, in excess of whatever you can take, in excess of that 25,000 amount, or because your Magi is over 150,000, you can't take any of that 25,000, you don't lose them, you carry them over into future years. And when you do have two ways you can unlock them with the carryovers, right? Either you have some passive income to offset those passive losses, right? And so you can net them in the future years, or when you actually dispose of the property, right? So when you turn around and sell the rental that has generated all those passive losses, when you sell it, you can then retake those passive losses that have carried over. So
the capital gains.
Yeah. So you're going to get those deductions, right? You're not going to just lose them because you weren't a real estate professional. It's just an issue of timing. Do you get to take it this year, or do you have to carry it over into a future year, right? So that's the key thing to remember also, right? Sometimes it's pitched as if, well, if you're not a real estate professional, you're just going to lose those losses, right? You're going to lose tax benefits. You're not going to lose them. You just don't get to take them yet. So the question there is it worth it? Is it worth giving up in this year? Is it worth giving up your W-2 job so that you can pass the first test, right? The more than half your hours in the real estate activity. First of all, is it worth giving up your W-2 job? And then second, is it worth all the time that you're trying to say that you're putting into this real estate portfolio of it's your first rental property ever? It's a single family home that you probably shouldn't be spending 750 hours a year on this one rental property, right? You should be spending maybe 75 and spend the rest of your time making real money at your W-2 job, right? Or starting a business on the side or something. So when you get to the point to where it's reasonable for you to qualify as a real estate professional and you've got a portfolio that's generating the kinds of tax losses that mean you want to unlock those losses as quickly as possible, now let's start looking at what you need to do to qualify.
That's great. I love that perspective, the timing. It sort of puts it into a different box because a lot of these things, like you said, you watch online, you get these little tidbits of information and you sort of get boxed into a very limited scope and understanding. And like, that is exactly why this podcast is being created, to carry the conversation out over 10, 15 episodes, yep, delving into the background and having that understanding and knowing, you know, if the one thing that you came out of listening to this is don't do the real estate professional status, let me focus on other things, you just saved yourself time, headache, and a lot of money.
It's all about cash flow. It's literally, I see so many people come to me and they're literally dropping dollars to pick up pennies. Like they're doing everything they can to reduce their tax bill and they're going broke because of it. I'm a huge advocate of doing everything you can to, what I say, optimize. I don't say minimize. I say optimize your tax bill. Because what are we optimizing it against? We're optimizing it against, one, your long-term tax liability. I don't want you to drastically reduce your tax liability today when you're going to have to pick up that tax liability down the road, right? Let's see if we can minimize the total over time. And then the second thing is, if you're sinking a ton of money, or for a lot of real estate investors, a ton of credit, right, and credit worthiness into investments that, you know, you were just chasing after deductions, but maybe you probably should have slowed down a little bit and waited on that property. Again, I'm a tax advisor. I'm not a financial advisor. So I'm going to tell you what makes sense from a tax perspective, but it would not be in my interest or in my customer's interest to tell them to make tax decisions that are going to cause them cash flow and personal finance problems. So I need you to be able to afford my bill. Right? Like basically is what I'm getting at. And so if you're sinking all your money and all your credit into trying to get deductions,
you're so selfish. Okay? You just want to get paid.
At the end of the day, you're broke, but you know, yeah, you've got this massive real estate portfolio, but you're leveraged to the hilt and you're trying to get all these tax deductions, but you can't afford my bill to prepare the return to get you those deductions. You didn't help yourself any there.
You just want to get paid. You just want to make sure your customers have enough money at the end of the day to be able to afford to pay you. Well,
I need you with cash in the bank and food in your belly, right? Because if either of those two things aren't true, I'm not getting paid, and that's a problem.
Right, you're not getting paid, and they don't have food to eat. So that's a double whammy.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Right. Like if you can do those things, and you want to buy another, you know, rental property, go for it. I'm all for it. But if buying another rental property means you either can't afford my bill, or you can't afford your next grocery bill, then we got problems.
Right, right. And I'm not a financial advisor either, even though I love to dish out advice. It's one of my favorite things to do, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
As credit cards, you know, don't go spending money because you're getting 5% back. If that purchase doesn't make sense, do not purchase it just because you'll get 5 or 6 or 7% back. Same thing with taxes.
Yes.
Don't make investments.
Yes.
Don't let the tail wag the dog.
Absolutely.
That's the dog whistle for Absolutely. Accountants, by the way.
I when I talk with other tax professionals, I'm in a lot of Facebook groups for tax professionals, and we'll get in there and we'll try to help each other out when we have, you know, situations with our customers or, you know, planning opportunities. And we just kind of want to run these ideas by other people in our profession. I'll see so many times where, you know, this is especially newer professionals where they'll come in there and they'll say, you know, hey, I've got this taxpayer. They want me to do this on their return. How do I make that work? And my first question is always, well, back up, right? Are you sure this is the right strategy? Would you have recommended the strategy? Would you have advised them to do this in the first place, right? Because like you said, there are a lot of times where it seems like it's the tax tail wagging the financial dog. That can get you into trouble. I don't want you to pay a cent more to the tax agencies than you have to. But again, I also don't want you going broke chasing after deductions.
Thank you, Jeremy, for your time.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to back up, understand the tax code from its origins, see what incentives are there for real estate. And, you know, for real estate professionals specifically, and how to sort of, let's say, approach it in a way that makes sense for you. And it's all about timing. If this year is a good year for your financial setup to go for the real estate professional status and you have the wherewithal and the rentals to do it, let's go, let's roll. But if it's not, so then, like we're saying now, don't chase pennies and lose the dollar.
Absolutely.
How could someone listening to this reach out to you?
I'm Jeremy Wells of JWells CFO. And so that's pretty much my handle across all the social media is at JWells CFO, WELLS CFO. That's my website too, jwellscfo.com.
And do you have a Threads handle already, or could I steal that? And
I already got that. I think it carried over from Instagram, but I've been on Threads a little bit. But I'm hanging on to the site formerly known as Twitter.
Right.
There's actually a pretty substantial, I mean, it feels substantial. I don't know how substantial it is in the big scheme of things, but there's a hashtag tax Twitter community on Twitter that is a lot of tax professionals, and many of them are specialists in real estate. And so it's a great place to go. And if you're in real estate investing, if you're tax minded, if you've got questions, feel free to come on out and, you know, into the site formerly known as Twitter and engage there.
Right, right. Now known as X.
That's right. I can't bring myself to say it. I still can't. What, it's been like 3, 4, 5 months now, and I just still can't do it.
Yeah, how come?
Just
say it.
I just want it to be Twitter. I just want it to be, like I say, you know, we're like, I've been part of, well, I've been in this profession almost 6 years, and Twitter's been a big source of both professional networking for me. Like I say, through that taxware community, I've met a lot of colleagues that, you know, have been great for me, that I've given good advice to. I met my mentor through Twitter now, you know, more than 6 years ago. And Twitter is a lot more to me than just a social media site. It's where me and a lot of my friends hang out. It's like if you had that pub around the corner, you know, and it changed ownership and changed names, like, you would still just want it to be that same old pub where you met up with your buddies at. Yeah.
Got it. Understood. It's like, you know, Chipotle taking over your local restaurant, you know, and it's just like, something's missing.
Exactly.
Then I guess we'll end with this, that Threads seems to be hanging by a thread.
It doesn't seem to be going anywhere either way.
Right.
So I guess that's an okay thing.
Yeah.
You know, but I think Meta, between Facebook and Instagram, I think Meta will be okay.
Mark Zuckerberg could definitely afford your services. Let's just say that, you know, he has food to eat and he could pay you. So Mark, if you're listening to this, Jeremy can make time for you. All right. Thank you, Jeremy, again for coming on, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Asher.